civilizations die from suicide, not by murder. That quotation comes from historian Arnold Toynbee and is dear to the heart of and central to the argument of Patrick J. Buchanan. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. We're shooting today in Washington, D.C. Speechwriter for President Nixon, communications director for President Reagan, candidate for president himself in 1992, 1996, and 2000, and longtime television and radio commentator Patrick J. Buchanan is the author of more than 10 books. His most recent book, Suicide of a Superpower. Pat, welcome.
Good to see you again, Peter.
I suppose in the interest of full disclosure, I should note that we've known each other since I was an intern for you when I was in college in 1977. I don't know about you, but I get a backache, when I say that.
I didn't recall it being that far back, 1977. Remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was 3 years out of the Nixon White House.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Civilizations die from suicide, right, not by murder. We'll come to the argument by argument in the book, but why do you lead the book with that quotation?
Well, because I think the West is disintegrating. It's the greatest civilization the world has ever produced, and I think it is dying. Take a look at what happened from the day, for example, my father was born in 1905. Western empires controlled the entire world, with the addition of Japan and Asia, six or seven countries, America included, controlled the entire world. We went through two world wars that carried off something like 100 million people, most of them Western peoples. And as a consequence, I think all these Western nations, they all lost their empires. Almost all have lost their armies and navies. They have lost their basic fundamental Christian faith. Certainly Europe, the Pope says, is a desert of godlessness. And as they have lost that, their culture has begun to disintegrate, and the people have begun to die. There's not a single Western nation whose native-born population has a birth rate that will enable it to stay in its present form through this century. Take a country like Italy. It's got a birth rate. Each new generation is one-third smaller than the last. Mm. Russia is going to lose 25 million people between now and 2050. It's already lost 10 million since independence, say, in 1990. Japan is going to lose 25 million people. You go down there, these are UN statistics. They're based on fertility records that go back when the nations began to die, basically to the mid-1970s. So I think you're going to see the West and its peoples shrink as a percentage of world population. All of them, I think, will be predominantly, in terms of their population by the end of this century, folks from the third world and from different cultures and civilizations. And the idea they're going to preserve Western culture and civilization, I think, is really putting hope over experience.
I'm going to try to recover enough to continue with the show. Segment one, immigration, suicide of a superpower. Quote, the European and Christian core of our country, you just gave an overview, right, now we're talking about the United States, is shrinking, while mass immigration is altering forever the face of America. Close quote. Now, what I want to do is draw some distinctions here to get at the central part of the argument. No descendant of Irish, Scots-Irish, and German immigrants can be against all immigration on principle. Mm-hmm. So draw the distinctions here. What is it about current immigration that's alarming as opposed to past immigrations?
Well, the past immigrations, let's take the large immigration that came in from 1890 to 1920. Those were folks, the Irish came in, of course, 1845 to 1849, the potato famine, huge numbers of them. Germans began coming in later in the century. And then you had the folks from Italy, from Poland, from Slovakia, Jews from Russia and the Pale of Settlement. And all of those folks came into this country basically by 1924 when the immigration restrictions were imposed. And this terrified Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt. However, we did have a melting pot then. One of the major elements of it was the parochial and public schools, which took these kids who didn't speak the language, and many of them came from broken families, and dropped them, immersed them into the America's popular culture and higher culture. They learned American literature, the American language, American history, American heroes, holidays, so that by 1960, 97% of the people in this country all spoke the English language. We all had basically the same Judeo-Christian values. 95% of the country was predominant, overwhelmingly Christian. African Americans were the most churched and Christianized of all. And so we had one country, one nation, one people. And it was an incredible achievement. And since then...
And it rested on, in the first place, a long breathing space. Mass immigration stops in 1924 and doesn't begin again until 65. Is that correct?
Exactly. You've got 40 years there. And in addition to the 40 years' time of children and grandchildren, you've got these experiences folks went through, the invention of radio. We're all listening to the same radio.
Popular culture.
You go through the Depression together, those tough times. We go through the war together, which I can remember as a little kid, the enormous patriotism everyone had. And then you go into the Cold War era, the early Cold War era, I would say to 1960, and you got an era of good feeling from Eisenhower and Kennedy. In that time, I mean, listen, the post-war era, as I can recall from my father, when he saw Harry Truman walking across the Ellipse wherever he played football, I mean, I was concerned of my old man was going to go after the guy. There was really, I mean, but he was walking himself in those days. There was a Truman-McCarthy era, you can call it, when politically we were at sword's point over what FDR had done and how we'd lost all the benefits of victory in World War II. But we were one nation and one people. My father was up at the Holy Name Society. I don't know, they probably abolished that now by now, but in that group, a number of them were Harry Truman Democrats, and my father and his friends wanted to invite Joe McCarthy to speak. And there's a huge uproar over that. But that's straight politics.
Right.
Now, what's happened subsequent to that, and I don't want to be long-winded in this answer, is that your whole consensus that kept us together has collapsed. We no longer have a common faith. From the 1960s, all those revolutions in the 60s, one of them was a rejection of Christianity, rejection of our moral consensus and moral code. Sexual revolution, the anti-war revolution, which degenerated into part of it into anti-Americanism. The civil rights revolution, which is initially about equal rights, has now moved on to entitlement and privilege. So I think the things that held us together, I see them all basically disintegrating, and you see society sort of breaking down and breaking apart, and I describe it as sort of balkanization of America. And I just
want to be really explicit, because there have been, you Google around on this book or on your name, and you get the word racism coming up.
Right.
I've known you for a long time, so I'm partial toward you, but I believe that on the argument of this book, that's nonsense.
Right.
You're not saying one race or one ethnic group is superior. What you're saying is the country needs a breathing space to assimilate people, and it's trickier now than it used to be because what you're assimilating them to, the matrix, is cracking up.
Right.
Is that correct?
Well, it's not only that, but I do believe that it is, as I once said famously, it is far more easy to assimilate if you had a million Englishmen coming into Virginia than if you had a million Zulu from my friend Chief Buthelezi's tribe. I mean, they have a hellish time assimilating them into South Africa where they've worked together or lived together for hundreds of years. Now, if you've got people from all over these Asia and Africa and Latin America that have never before been assimilated, you need to have that basic melting pot needs to be more powerful than ever, stronger than ever, and you've got to have time to work with it. But our multicultural elites have thrown that out. People are urged to come into this country, retain their culture, their religion, their traditions, their customs, all the rest of it. So we are becoming like, I think increasingly, the Balkan Peninsula, Croats and Serbs and Montenegrins and Macedonians and others. And the major problem, I think, on immigration, and these folks are Catholic folks by and large, are the folks coming in from Mexico and from Latin America. There are now 50 million. It used to be about 2 million. And it's estimated at 135 million, predominantly in the Southwest.
Right.
I think those folks will culturally, socially, linguistically have one foot in Mexico as well as one in the United States. And are you risking a giant Kosovo in the United States of America? And so I think these are things, look, if you took, say, 100,000 Hispanic Americans and do as George Washington said, all the immigrants should be moved around to various communities so basically they can assimilate
right,
more easily.
Right, or Samuel Huntington, the late Harvard right. professor, wrote a book in which he, Huntington is no liberal.
Right.
He was no conservative, but he said the problem here, identified in particular one problem. In the old days, immigrants tended to disperse.
Right.
Italians violated that to some extent. To this day, 80% of people of Italian right. descent live within 500 miles of New York. But still, they disperse, they learn the language. What's
you
different
learn
now?
Something new every day, 80%.
Yeah, huh? Yeah, it's a high percent.
Right.
And but now you've got across the Southwest a huge
right.
population that's not dispersing, was Huntington's argument. That's right. something new and something uniquely in our history.
Right. Well, it's enormous. I mean, you have 135 million. You have that's about 30 million more than there are people in Mexico. You have a nation within a nation.
Yeah. So let me try you this one. Right. My friend, Victor Davis Hanson, you and he have gone after each other in print
right.
a few times.
Right.
Victor lives in Selma. He's fourth or fifth generation in a ranch in the Central Valley of California. He has seen immigration.
Tell Victor good luck.
Well, he's seen it all with his own eyes.
Sure.
Victor says, today, California, his beloved California, there's no problem that 20 years of cooling it wouldn't solve.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so what I'm trying to say is,
if you could put a wall
on the border, would 20 years solve the problem, or is it gone?
You know, well,
how dark is your view? That's what I'm asking.
I think you've got if there is a solution, this would be it, as I argue at the end of the book. First, you've got to put a security fence on the border because we're being invaded, basically. And they're not evil people, but they're coming in here because what is here is a lot better for them than what they leave at home. Do a security fence on the border and do all the things to stop illegal immigration. I would stop
and legal, force the law, start
force
there.
It, yeah, and I would legal immigration. I would halt all legal immigration except for, obviously, there are some cases, like for about 250,000 a year could come in. But stop it until unemployment gets to 6% in the United States. Why are you bringing in each year 1 million people to work in the United States when we got 23 million people who are unemployed or underemployed? What are you doing to your own people, black, white, Asian, whatever, by bringing in new workers when you got this enormous unemployment problem? It doesn't make sense. And you mentioned legal immigration. Halt that for a while. Oh, my goodness. The point is Americans are deeply ideologized, if you will, to say immigration good, and therefore we can't stop it. Something's wrong if we do. But we did stop it for 40 years. And during our first 60 years of existence as a nation, there was virtually zero. I mean, there was a very small immigration, something like 20,000,
right.
I think, in the 1820s or something like that.
Right.
So you have to, but this is one of the reasons it's suicide of a superpower. You can't even discuss these things.
Yeah.
And so, and if you can't, then you're not going to solve it.
Right. Segment two, faith. You begin chapter two of Suicide of a Superpower, which is entitled, chapter two is entitled The Death of Christian America, with three quotations. Woodrow Wilson, America was born a Christian nation. Harry Truman, your dad's favorite.
Right.
Harry Truman.
That was in a letter to the Pope, Harry Truman wrote. Probably yeah. wasn't a fan of his coming from Missouri and where he did.
That
Go
could
ahead.
Be. It's the quotation is, right? This is a Christian nation. Barack Obama, the third of these quotations, we do not consider ourselves a Christian nation. Explain the significance of those three.
Well, the Christianity and both the Protestant Catholic versions, if you will, Catholics about one-fourth of the country or were, this is basically the cradle faith of Western civilization. The Roman Empire collapses and you come into, quote, the Dark Ages. They weren't all that dark. Christianity basically revived Europe, created and defined the new Europe, Christian civilization, the West. That is the cradle faith. That is what holds us or held us all together as a community and as a civilization. Now, the faith is dying. It is dead, as I said. The Pope says, you know, it's a desert of godlessness in Europe.
Benedict XVI. Right.
And more people go to a mosque in Great Britain on Fridays than go to church on Sundays. So Christianity is dying or dead in Europe. In the United States, the number of Christians is down to 75%. What does this mean now? It means one of the things that held us together is gone. But secondly, Christianity is the basis of your moral consensus, the moral code by which a community lives. And we know from post-1960s, look at all these culture war issues. You got the abortion and homosexuality and gay marriage and stem cell research, all these things ripping us apart. These divisions are rooted in the death of faith in the hearts of minds, or its non-existent, of a huge slice of the population and probably a majority of its elite. So we have basically, as someone said famously at Houston in 1992, a religious war going on in this country.
Pat, Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens,
right?
On this very program, quote, "Our knowledge of right and wrong is innate in us. Don't need religion for morality." Mm-hmm. "We know that we can't get along if we permit perjury, theft, murder, rape," mm-hmm. close quote. Now, I'm being provocative by putting those in the words of Christopher Hitchens. I don't want to get in a fight over the catechism with a graduate of Gonzaga and Georgetown, but isn't it the teaching of the church itself that we have natural law graven in our hearts, a matter of conscience, that basic morality precedes religion?
Right.
So isn't there some hope?
And it's consistent with true religion. Exactly.
Right.
Perfectly consistent. All right, let's take
the
issue.
Do you see what I'm arguing here?
I see exactly what you're arguing.
Go ahead.
But let's take a look at the issue of abortion. 53 million abortions. Now, this is, in America I grew up in, that would have been comparable to what went on in the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany. People would have said that's just impossible. It was illegal in virtually every state, criminal. Armin Hammer's old man was an abortionist who went to prison. So that is a dramatic change. Homosexuality and homosexual marriages. If you criticize them today, that's one of the reasons I'm no longer at MSNBC. This human rights campaign said, look what Buchanan said. He said homosexuality is unnatural and immoral. That was not a controversial statement up until very, very recently. So what I say is, if you've got no moral, common moral consensus or moral code, you don't have a community anymore. And as Christianity diminishes, there's a political aspect here. 90% of all presidential votes for Republicans come from nominal Christians. 90% come from European Americans, white folks, okay? That's what McCain's, with Nixon and Reagan in their landslides, they were even higher, because the percentages of minority folks. Now, Christians went from 85 down to 75%, and they're steadily declining. Some of these, as I write, some of these traditional old Methodists, the Presbyterians, Episcopalians, those churches are disintegrating and dying. Catholic Church is in trouble. So 75% Christian vote continues to fall, and the white vote, which provides 90% of Republicans, is down to 74% of the electorate and 63% of the nation. It continues to fall. As that continues, and there's nothing going to stop it, as that continues, the states of Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, and Colorado go the way of California. Now, what's California? Well, Ronald Reagan ran four times in California, won it in four huge landslides. Richard Milhouse Nixon of Orange County fame.
I remember that name.
He was on five national tickets, and those tickets won California every time. He got the highest majority ever gotten as of 1950 in a Senate race. He did lose the governorship. But California is gone.
I said
it is gone.
After Meg Whitman ran for governor, I talked to Mike Murphy, who was advising her. Mike Murphy, political consultant, Georgetown graduate.
Right.
I said, Mike, why'd she lose? And he said, she could never win. California's a blue state. It's just gone.
Just gone. The others are gone. Hoover Institution should be looking at a new site.
Well, I'm telling my children to look at real estate in Texas. Mm-hmm. Listen, I'm trying to give you a little hope here.
Right.
All right? Obama administration announces a regulation that would force Catholic organizations to offer health insurance plans that cover contraceptives, abortifacients, and so forth, all in violation of Catholic teaching. Mm-hmm. And what happens? Do the bishops, who for decades now have spent more time in politics, in my crude and possibly unfair characterization, than they have engaged in teaching the teachings of the church, lie down and take it? No.
Right.
Obamacare is responsible for a medical miracle because across America, bishops suddenly grow spines and they push back. Mm-hmm. And they have polls show huge support among Catholic people and indeed Protestant people. You've even got Archbishop Chaput of Philadelphia speaks to a pro-life gathering. Listen to this. This is directed at you, Patrick J. Buchanan. Changing the course of American culture seems like a huge task, but St. Paul felt exactly the same way. Redeeming a civilization has already been done once. It can be done again.
Has he been following me on TV? Because I've been asked a question, you know, if we get the right politics, I said, look, the solution to America's problem isn't going to come even from a Ronald Reagan. It's going to take a St. Paul, because this is what you are talking about, reconverting an entire nation away from the direction in which it is going. And that is why there is such pessimism in this book. Now, did the bishops do a good job on this one? They did an excellent job on this one, standing up, saying, you're not going to force us to do things that violate our conscience. And the first time I was down there at St. Mary's, where they had the Latin Mass, somebody got up in the pulpit and read a letter from Cardinal Worrell, and it was terrific. But look how
don't
far.
You think, I mean, if you think of the previous generation of bishops, Cardinal Bernardine in Chicago, the seamless garment, which I'm being unfair to say so, but it seemed to me a form. In practice, it was cooperation with the Democratic Party. Mahoney out in Los Angeles, same thing. He came up with the elaborate theological justification for effectively supporting the Democratic Party. Well, now you've got new red hat Cardinal Dolan up in New York.
Right.
This guy's just gotten punched in the nose. Mm-hmm. This new generation is tougher in the first place, and these bishops suddenly see that's it. This game is right.
Let me agree with you, but look where we are fighting from.
Yeah.
I mean, if you had done this, no administration would have dared to do or attempt something like this back in the 1950s, 60s, or 70s.
Right.
Look at how far they've moved the frontier of the state into the church and overwhelmed it thus far, to the point where our backs are against the wall. And suddenly we decide, hey, they're going to run right over us unless we fight. And so I think they have done a good job here. But the very fact that the state would attempt something like that and then demand a compromise suggests to me that, the retreat has been long and ignominious.
Right. Segment 3, trait, suicide of a superpower, quote, the industrial evisceration of the United States will continue until we make nothing the world wants but Hollywood movies, close quote. By the way, I think that's a little hopeful. Bollywood is going to take over Hollywood. But go ahead and explain that argument.
Well, it's the United States of America. When I ran in 1992 and 91, I used to be a free trader, a Milton Friedmanite free trader, until Milton wrote me a letter in 1990 or so, and he said, Patrick, you are doing the devil's work. And I said,
way to make a
Milton,
friend.
You know, Milton... take a look. I was a free trader, but take a look at the consequences of this doctrine, this policy we have all believed in, conservatives, certainly from 1960 when I was entered the movement. And I've been out here, and I'm taking a look at these consequences, and it is creating a disaster. And I said, if you go with NAFTA and GATT and the World Trade Organization and take this nation with the highest standard of living in the world, the highest wages, the toughest regulations on manufacturing, and you drop it into a pool where there's about 1 billion foreign workers who will work for 1/10 of it, you will lose every manufacturing job in the United States. In the last decade, the Bush II decade, the United States lost 55,000 factories and 6 million manufacturing jobs, one of every three we had in the United States of America. And that's what gets me a little agitated about seeing these Republicans, all of them out there, free trade Republicans, saying we got to get manufacturing back. They all voted for NAFTA. They all voted for GATT. They all went with the World Trade Organization. They all went with MFN for China. And look at last year alone. The Chinese, we sold $100 billion worth of products to the Chinese, a lot of it raw materials and stuff. And they sold us $400 billion. They ran a $300 billion trade surplus. And they're taking that money and they're moving all over the world and buying resources up. They are practicing what our forefathers practiced in the 19th century. And we're acting like the British, the Cobdenites, and all the rest of that crowd in the British Empire who blew it in the second half of the 19th century by practicing free trade while the Americans dumped products into their markets and protected our own with a tariff.
Okay, couple statistics. The United States is still the biggest manufacturing economy in the world. We produce a fifth of the world's total manufacturing output.
We're tied to the Chinese.
In terms of real dollars, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, American factories produced, real dollars, real terms, 57% more goods in 2010 than they did in 1987. Manufacturing is up. What's down is jobs.
Sure.
Productivity is way up. Mm-hmm. So even as the 19th century comes to a close and 80-85% of Americans are employed in agriculture, the employment in agriculture drops quickly and steadily throughout the 20th century, but the productivity is up. We're growing more food. Likewise, manufacturing, the factories are manufacturing in the last 6 months. I may be wrong about this because the data I was looking at may be about a year old. I can't remember to tell you the truth. But in any event, manufacturing is growing pretty quickly and was for a period in the last 18 months the hottest, most quickly growing sector.
You're saying Obama's doing a good job?
I'm saying that, well, I'm saying your argument, what you want, you're talking about manufacturing jobs rather than about manufacturing. So I'm saying your argument is, I'm putting this to you, in the first place, it's not with free trade, it's with what the teachers' unions have done to American education. If you want Americans to be competitive in the world, you've got to get them good schooling. And your argument is, with all these regulations that make a factory owner say, well, now, wait a minute here, do I employ 10 more people or do I make a capital investment in a piece of machinery that's never going to have to collect Social Security, on which I'm not going to have to worry about Obamacare? So those are your arguments. That's what I'm putting to you, Pat.
Who's going to make the machinery? Who's going to make the robots, all of these things? My view is this. There's a lot of people in this country, a number of them, who really do not have the academic skills and abilities or natural academic abilities to do college work in the various, in all kinds of studies. However, they have always been more than able to do work with their hands, tools, and machines. At one point, we produced 42% of all the world produced in manufactures. Americans built of the machines of war, I think half of all the machines of war used on both sides in World War II. My view is very simple. If it can be made here, it should be made here. I don't believe in global free trade, putting Americans making 30 or 20 bucks an hour into competition with folks making $2 an hour. Why did the Chinese sell $400 billion to us and buy $100 billion? 1994, they simply cut the value of their currency in half, which doubled the price of our goods coming in, and cut the price of their goods going out by 50%. I mean, these people manipulate their currencies, and they do it to bring manufacturing home. This is not, people talk about a level playing field. Vince Lombardi did not say, all I want is a level playing field. He said, winning is the only thing. And we ought to realize this, you know, this is a rivalry, a competition. It's not war, but it's a lot closer to war than it is to what these folks are talking about. And I think, here's what I would do. Put a 30% tariff on all manufactured goods or all goods entering the United States. That'd give you $600 billion. Eliminate all corporate taxation in the United States. Every company in the world would say...
You got me on point two for sure.
Right, okay, but here's what companies would say. Let's say Toyota gets its cars assembled here and say, look, if we send in the parts, the drivetrains, batteries, tires, all those things, from here they're going to pay a 30% tariff. Why don't we just move our factory there and produce there? That's what countries do. And so I'm saying that economic nationalism, which Russell Kirk told me, late Russell Kirk said, Pat, use economic patriotism. We don't like nationalism. I said, that's fine. Economic patriotism, just the idea that we are in competition, healthy competition with other countries, and do what is best for American workers, and forget about the global economy, because nobody else is thinking about that. Everybody else is thinking about themselves.
But one of the things that's best for American workers is being able to buy products inexpensively.
Look at
the camera and say, ladies and gentlemen, join the Buchanan program, and you will pay twice as much for everything you buy at Walmart, which is the largest retailer in America and also, by the way, the largest employer in America. You slap on tariffs, and all the stuff they buy in China is going to jump in price. Do you see what I'm saying?
Sure. Let me talk to your camera.
All right.
When I was a kid... When I was a kid, Converse All-Stars were the best tennis shoes made, and the kids cost $3, and they cost $5 a pair. Now you can get them from Indonesia for $150 a pair. Do you really think it costs that much to make them? Of course not. That's just what they charge in the United States over and above how much it costs to make them over there. Listen, you bring these things back to the United States, well, everybody's going to have to compete here. The idea that, I mean, as long as you got that tariff, you take all that revenue, cut the taxes on producers here, and they will beat everybody in the world.
So markets don't really work.
Markets, look, I believe in a freer market than we have right now, but I do believe in national borders for markets. Why, what kind of globalist says it's a good thing if our factories move from here to China?
Last question.
Because maybe we get something cheaper.
Are you signed up then with the Romney program on China? To tell you the truth, I don't understand the details. Right. I'm not sure he's laid out a detailed policy. I haven't found it on his website yet. But he's clearly riled about China in a healthy way.
He is.
And it's a start.
I've seen Mitt Romney has talked about. He has said, people say if we do this, we're going to be in a trade war. He said, what do they think we're in now? Peter, the last year, we had a trade deficit of something like $550 billion trade deficit.
They send us real goods. They send us real objects, and we give them piece of promissory notes.
Well, we give them the same promissory notes that put this country in debt. And what do they do with those notes? They go and buy the resources of Australia, of Africa, all the rest of it. Well, we're out there with our foreign aid and all the rest of it. They are serious people. Look. The Chinese are sacrificing now. As you say, they're taking paper. Their people are
sacrificing underpaid. Consumption for sure.
They're sacrificing the present for the future, and we're sacrificing the future for the present. They will own the future as we own the present.
Segment 4, The Empire. In a section of Suicide of a Superpower entitled, quote, The Cold War Conservatives, you contrast Eisenhower and Reagan on the one hand with Bush the Elder and Bush the Younger on the other. Give us a brief. I found that passage fascinating. Give us that contrast.
Well, Eisenhower was, and I regret to say we weren't very, I mean, we liked Ike, but he was sort of an old gentleman. We were kids.
And he got a little rough on MacArthur, too, on McCarthy.
Who? Yeah, he did, but Joe went a little bit over the line by then.
I can see you're recalling dinner table conversations in the Buchanan
household.
But
I was at the Burning Tree Country Club. I used to see Ike would come out there, and he'd tee off, and the Secret Service guys would go down the left and right side of the run of the fairway, and they only had two clubs in there, and I didn't think they were clubs. But I remember him, and everybody liked Ike, but it was, and when the Democrats had Kennedy and everything, they had a very exciting, challenging candidate, and we were looking for our own. But let me say about Eisenhower, look what he did. He came in, and he said, this war is bleeding us to death.
Korea.
And he said, I'm going to end it in 6 months. And the Chinese hesitated, and he said, if you don't come to the table and talk, we're taking all the limits off what we're going to use on you fellas. The Chinese came to the table. He did the same thing in the Taiwan Straits in 58. He sent, these 8-inch mortars over there, and the guys knew 8-inch mortars were atomic capable. So Ike was a very tough guy, but he didn't want to get it. He'd seen war. He didn't want to get his country into another war. And I think he did a tremendous job building up our defenses.
And from the time the Korean War ended, about, 6-8 months into Eisenhower's administration?
June 53.
Until he left office, how many Americans died in combat? One. Mm-hmm. A sniper got a guy in Lebanon. Only one.
Mm-hmm.
Just to make your point.
Well, that's exactly right. And look at Reagan. I mean, you worked with Ronald Reagan. We worked in the White House. And I'll tell you a story that Marlon Fitzwater told me. He was in the Oval Office.
Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater.
He was in the Oval Office with one other fella on the day of the inaugural of his successor, George H.W. Bush. And Reagan came in and said, worst mistake I ever made was putting those Marines in Lebanon. Then Reagan went, saluted, and left. And that was right. That's one thing, Reagan thing he did that I opposed, because I'd been over to Israel and everything, and the Israelis say, we're going to take us up to Beirut. They'd already overrun southern Lebanon. And then they said, we don't think you ought to go. And I said, the only reason we ain't going to go is because they're not going to throw rocks at us. They're going to shoot us. Right. So if that's the situation, why should we put Marines in? We shouldn't put them in. So what did he do? Grenada, he did Lebanon, and one of the speeches I wrote, which was the attack on Libya.
Right.
And look what happened after that. Of course, they blew up that Pan Am plane in
Lockerbie.
But anyhow, Reagan believed in building up and dealing from strength. And looking at the Soviets who believed in that, Reagan can lay out all these cards. This is everything we got economically, militarily, et cetera. Now let's deal. And I think I believe in that in the Bush 1 and Bush 2. I remember late Hugh Seide told me, you know, and we went over to the last day, or it was they gave Reagan a Medal of Freedom. I was
That's
invited
right.
there.
That's right.
Were you
we
there?
Were in the, yeah, we were in the room together, the East
right.
Room together. That's
yeah,
right.
East Room together, and that was after I'd run against Bush 1, and I was way high up there, Peter, in the balcony. But Hugh Seide said, you know, they're going to have to tear this guy's finger off the trigger here. I mean, Bush 1 was in Somalia, he was all Haiti, I mean, he was in Panama, and he's, you know, Desert Storm, and he loved doing all that New World Order stuff. And what does it all come to now? I mean, what have we done? We've done Panama, we've done Haiti, we've done Somalia, we've done Desert Storm, we've done Gulf War, we've done Libya, we've done all these Afghanistan, all these places. What have all these things availed the United States in the last 20 years as we have steadily begun to lose global leadership to China, which hasn't gotten itself, it seems, into any wars? What have all these wars availed America?
So the counter-argument would be Ike and Reagan demonstrate wonderful restraint, admiration, fully due them. At the same time, we have to recognize that the world is in a kind of freeze at that point because you've got a nuclear-armed superpower over there and a nuclear-armed superpower over here, and the tensions are going to take place just on this narrow border, Taiwan, Korea, and so forth, which Ike froze up. Bush 1 comes along, and the Cold War ends. Right. Bush 2 comes along, and it's long over. The Soviet Union was never responsible for an atrocity like 3,000 dead on our own soil. Mm-hmm. Bush 1 and more so Bush 2 are in a completely different situation where the world is suddenly open and dangerous in a way that it wasn't. It was ultimately dangerous. Bush 2 is not facing a nuclear threat like Ike and Reagan, but conventionally the thing is much hotter all of a sudden. What does it avail us? The argument is Al-Qaeda's fragmented. Iran is a crude place, but it represents a functioning democracy, at least for now. We've seen an Arab Spring, which offers the hope of, for the first time in
You're
Arab history...
You're pretty hopeful on this thing?
Well, it's the hope of some kind of government that bears some relation to the consent of the governed. In other words, you could say that he got us someplace.
Well, the point is we are not responsible for all these things. A lot of these have just occurred. On Afghanistan, I would agree with this, all of us. Once you ran down that massacre of 3,000 Americans to Al-Qaeda and you tell the Taliban, turn these SOBs over to us or we're going to come get them.
Right.
And the Taliban says, no, we said we're going to ask you one more time. Turn them over, we're going to come get you. And they don't do it. I agreed 100% with going in there, knocking over the Taliban, going to Tora Bora, capturing or killing the people that did that. But at that point, we should have gone back to Kabul and said, you see what happens when this happens to us, it happens to you. Now, don't let it happen again, or next time it's going to be worse. Goodbye and good luck. What are we doing in there trying to build a nation out of this 7th century civilization over there? You know Burke. What did he say? Men of intemperate minds can never be free. Their passions forge their fetters. Take a look at what's been happening the last week, where all these nutballs are running around the street because their holy books were burned.
Right.
All right? I'm not saying they're bad people and they're very devout and I have nothing against them. But the idea that you can turn that into the, you know, into the 13 colonies is preposterous.
Okay. The suicide of a superpower. Quote, the more we shrink our defense perimeter, the greater the gain in national unity behind our foreign policy. All right. Let's see. I want to see how far Mr. Buchanan wants to shrink it. We still have 60,000 troops in Western Europe. Get them out of there.
Bring them home.
South Korea, 30-some thousand troops. Get them out.
Bring them out and confine yourself. Tell the South Koreans you've got an economy that's 40 times as large as the North, population twice as large as the North. We've got about 28,000 troops in there. We're going to take them off the DMZ where they're hostages. You put your troops there. American naval and air power will continue to surround the area. But we're not fighting another land war in South Korea.
You want forward naval bases in the Pacific? You want Okinawa? Or you bring them all the way
back
to
Pearl?
I'd
get them off Okinawa because we're already... Obama's bringing them off there. They're not going to build that new air base in the north of Okinawa. I would bring them back to Guam. Bring them off these foreign territories where a lot of people are sick of having occupation troops. You know, like they're like when they call them like guests. After 3 or 4 days, you get tired of them.
Okay, now let me just want the distinctions here. So get the ground troops home. What about the United States Navy? You want to build more carriers? You want to build the Navy down?
No. I think the Navy needs to be very, very strong because basically we are an island continent. It's got to be strong because that's one of the basically you have to be able to project power and force on adversaries. But, you know, as Gates said, Secretary of Defense, anybody that recommends the United States fight another land war on the Asian continent ought to have his head examined.
Which he said at West Point. It's not as if nobody was listening. He chose the audience.
Right. And that's right. But we're not going to send another army. I mean, when I was a kid, we sent 350,000 to Korea, 525,000 to Vietnam. We're not going to do that again.
Iran. Let them have the nuke?
Well, I don't think Iran, I'm not sure Iran, first, I agree with the folks that are saying, these people are rational actors. I can't think back in history the last time they attacked anybody. Iran is a country which is between one-half and two-thirds Persian. It's got Azeris, it's got Kurds, it's got Arabs, it's got Baluch, all of whom want to break away. They don't want a war, all-out war with the United States, because they could get that in an afternoon. I mean, they could have... My friend, the Saudi ambassador, if they'd blown him up at some restaurant, which I think is sort of suspicious, this so-called attack on the United States by the Iranians.
Right.
Look, they've had
It's suspicious in the sense that you're not sure the Iranians did it?
I'm not. There was somebody sent some money over from Iran, but the idea that the Ayatollah was behind this, no, I don't believe it. I think they're much more. I mean, these are people that say, you know, if they get close to a bomb, they're just going to throw it, they're going to put it, give it to terrorists. And they're going to blow up Baltimore, or they're going to blow up Tel Aviv, or something like that. Do I believe that? No, I don't. No, I don't. So basically, I agree with the Obama administration that Joint Chiefs now, the Panetta and the Defense Department, that the United States, they have not made a decision over there in Iran, I think, to put together a bomb. There's no doubt. I mean, once I read my physics book and understood how you put together a uranium bomb, you have knowledge of it that increases if you're working on nuclear power. That's undeniable. But I don't think we want a war with Iran.
Hold on. So the risk would be they get a bomb. They are now untouchable. They can now dominate the region. I mean, they're untouchable.
You think North Korea dominates the region?
I think North Korea is untouchable. Well, I think North Korea is in a position to...
What have they done with their bomb?
They've kept their people in subjection.
And they kept us from attacking them,
okay.
Which is what Tehran wants.
But let me put the argument. You get Tehran, you give them the nuclear weapon.
I'm not going to give them anything. Go ahead.
You permit them to get the... You forbear to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon. You permit them to dominate the region. I'm giving you the argument. Permit them to dominate the region. You put them in a position to blackmail Western Europe with regard to oil, and we've got this guy, Ahmadinejad, who has said at least a couple times, of which I'm aware, that he wants to drive Israel into the sea.
Right.
And you've got a population, small country, Israel, three correctly placed nuclear weapons, and you've got a second Holocaust. And all of that, on top of which, who knows what they can hand off to terrorists. There's your danger.
Well, let's start first. Ahmadinejad has got an awful lot of Baghdad Bob in him. He is a BSer. He is out of favor with the Ayatollah. He was just about on the verge of impeachment. He does not control the military, and he's leaving office in the middle of next year. This guy frightens the Americans. Oh, he did have a Holocaust conference that featured David Duke. Okay, we're frightened of this, the United States of America, of Eisenhower and Reagan. All right, I don't believe Iran wants the bomb. I think they want the capability to build a bomb, but I don't think they want it for this reason. They get one, Turks get one, the Saudis get one, the Egyptians get one, and they are Persian and they are Shia in a Sunni Arab world. They get no new security. They're going to intimidate the Israelis? Are you kidding? Israelis got 200 to 300 atom bombs. If somebody's an existential threat to somebody right now, it's Israel is an existential threat to Iran. They're the ones flying planes out to Gibraltar, testing them, flying them toward Greece. They're the ones that are every day in the news that who are thinking, we can't take this, we're going to attack them first. I think the Iranians, but who, they're going to get an atom bomb and dump, what are they going to tell us to do, get out of the Gulf?
Yeah.
And then we say no.
And?
And what do they do?
Things get balls a little tense. Things get a little tense.
Yeah, the ball's in your court, Tehran.
All right. Listen, on Israel, you're talking about existential
threat.
They're going
to attack the United States of America?
You're not, you don't want
I mean,
you're
look,
not comparing Israel with Iran. I mean, Britain has had nuclear weapons. France has had. Nobody calls them an existential threat. So your point is, let the Saudis, let the Israelis.
I don't say let it. I don't. Look, here's what I would do. First, I would tell the Iranians, and I'm sure we have. Look, we've got, first they've got the at Natanz and Fordo and all these places. All these things are under IAEA observation by cameras with inspections there, and they're under seal. And you would tell them, this is all the enriched uranium. They got it to 5% for the plant, and they do it for 20% because we wouldn't send them the medical, the 20% that you need for medical. I mean, and I benefited from nuclear medicine, as a matter of fact. So we wouldn't send them 20%. What I tell them is, we got this all under lock and key. You guys open that out and you take it out and anywhere, or we find that you've used these centrifuges to enrich it beyond 20%, and there's only one purpose for that, you're building for a bomb. I think then you have to make a...
And you're going to rely on the IAEA, the United Nations to...
Well, the IAEA is taking a harder line than the Joint Chiefs right now. They got this Japanese fellow in there who I think is very much sort of on the hawk side. And so what I would do is I would tell the Iranians, look, quietly, look, we know what you got, we know where you're moving, and if you've crossed these red lines... And the only reason you would cross a red line like that is if you're intending to build a bomb, then there's going to be a fire bell in the night in the West and in the United States. I wouldn't tell them what I'm going to do. But if they do that, then they've made a decision to go for a bomb. But look, these are tough American military officers who have studied this their whole lives. They say they haven't made the decision to go for a bomb. They haven't. With regard to the uranium, they have not taken any of this uranium out to enrich it to 90%. If they do, I think then you've got a far different situation. But do I want to go to war with Iran? No. And why is this our responsibility?
Okay. But so I've got it now. You're not saying, oh, let them have a bomb. You're not saying that. You're saying quietly, using diplomacy, right, and relying on our strength in the background, set up the red lines and let them know where they are.
I think they've been set up, and I think they know where they are.
Okay.
But the problem with here is the Israelis. Now, the Israelis are fearful that Iran will and is developing a capability which could translate down the road into building a bomb. And there's no doubt that is true. And they want, but they can't take out all these plants. And there's an element of absurdity to bombing plants where the IAEA inspectors have all the uranium under seal. And so I think the Israelis are in a hellish situation. What they want to do, I think, is make an attempt or get the United States, which could do the job, get the United States to do a shock and awe on Iran like we did on Iraq and us fight that war. But our guys think, correctly I think, that's not in the interest of the United States because that whole place, that whole region could go up in a Sunni-Shia battle of all against all. And Americans could be killed in Lebanon by Hezbollah. They could be killed in Afghanistan,
right,
by Iranians. So our people are looking out for our interests, and the Israelis are looking out for their interests. And the point here is, unlike what Governor Romney said, the interests of Israel are here, and the interests of the United States are here. And that is the problem you're getting with Netanyahu coming here to talk to Obama. And I happen on this one to agree with the Joint Chiefs and Panetta and President Obama if he's reluctant to take us to war.
Okay.
This is not an endorsement.
Israel. Israel is and should be an ally. But they have their interests, and we have ours, and they do not always coincide exactly.
That's
correct?
Going to get you in trouble if you make a statement like that,
I'm
Peter.
Summing up Patrick J. Buchanan.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
I mean, the Israelis have their own interests in the region. They're much more narrow than ours because the United States remains a world power. Look, you know, my uncle fought in North Africa, and the Arabs were very, very friendly. And you have Arabs and Muslims, 1.5 billion Muslims, over 300 million Arabs. We have to have, as a great power and a world power, we want good relations with all of those folks. And the American people deeply admire and like Israel. You want good relations with them. But we have different and broader interests than the Israelis do. And often our interests collide. And when they do, you need people who will stand up for the United States, even if it means taking a certain amount of hits in American society. Read Washington's farewell address. All right. It's right in there, Peter.
I'm trying to... Segment 5, The Loyalist. This book, Suicide of a Superpower, cost you a job. Mm-hmm. MSNBC President Phil Griffin, quote, "I don't think the ideas Buchanan put forth in Suicide of a Superpower are appropriate for the national dialogue, much less on MSNBC," close quote.
Why are you putting these ideas on the air then, Peter?
NBC created a market opening for me. Question, does he really believe that, or is MSNBC just engaging in niche marketing and repositioning themselves to the left?
You know, the truth
What's
is...
What's going on?
Well, the truth is I had a very good 10 years at MSNBC. Folks, I have friends in front of the camera and behind the camera. I knew this book would be controversial, and the fact that it caused the breach or caused my departure from MSNBC, I'll let folks decide whether that says something about my book or something about MSNBC.
Describe the television set that H.R. Haldeman had built for his office.
That was Herb Klein's,
with
wasn't
the three?
It? Was the,
I thought it was Haldeman's.
You know, where, no, he got it from LBJ.
Oh, really?
Yeah, LBJ had it.
So Gergen had it when I was there. Go ahead.
Gergen?
Gergen had it in his office when I was there.
That does not surprise me.
Okay.
You better clip that out.
Two little screens and one big one so that the White House could monitor all three evening newscasts at the same time.
Well, here's the thing. I think it was LBJ's, and it went to Herb Klein, and this one was a piece of cabinet work, very large cabinet work, and you hit a clicker, and these doors opened up, and they were three 36-inch television sets on all three networks at one time. And you could click from one to another to see which one LBJ didn't like at that particular time. But everybody marveled. They would go in and look at Herb saying, I did not know it wound up with Gergen, but I should have anticipated that.
But the point is, in those days, which is not all that long ago, all you needed was three screens to keep up with the electronic media. Today, 500 channels, talk radio, 24-hour, which media environment did you prefer? Which was fairer? Which was better at informing the American people?
Since I wrote the Agnew speech attacking the three networks, we can't go with that model. I think 24-hour cable has some real problems attendant to it. But I think it's better in the sense that folks can get, what they want much more quickly. And when you got only a half hour of news, and I don't know how much, I noticed in the Nixon administration, certainly, they picked and chose what they wanted to put on the air, and you felt like these people are controlling the communication devices by which we speak to the American people and the nation. They are standing on our windpipe. And when Nixon's tried to win or end the Vietnam War, like that November 3rd speech, and all three of them start trashing it as soon as it's over and trot out Averill Harriman to trash it, that was the reason I said, look, we have to attack these people because they control how we are seen by the American people, and they don't like us.
Mental experiment. Rush Limbaugh exists beginning in 1970. How's history different?
Oh, I think talk radio is talk radio has been an extraordinary asset of the American conservative movement and the American right because it is competitive. And what it showed, one thing it showed was that conservative opinion and thought and ideas were desired by an enormous number of Americans, and folks driving in cars and folks driving on the trucks on highways, they voted for these conservatives. You go down and list the 100 and top talkers. There might be a couple liberals in there.
But only a couple.
There's only a couple in these, the big ones, you know, get Rush in there, you get Hannity in there, get Laura in there, and all the others. And they're very conservative, and I think this has really become a real outlet for conservative ideas and issues. But I do think this, these, the breaking it down into the, in the MSNBC versus Fox thing, reflects what's in that book, which is the division, the polarization, and the divorce and separation of Americans from Americans on issue after issue after issue, you know, religious, cultural, moral, ethnic. I mean, take a look
at the media is balkanized, as is the country.
Well, it is, and it also, it's, I mean, you can go, I mean, I remember, you know, a racist back when I was growing up was Bull Connor, you know, putting the fire hoses on folks. Now you can hear that comment thrown out about anybody on, you hear it on cable TV, panels just throw it out. Well, he's a racist.
Right. Pat Buchanan, the man. Your MSNBC colleague, Chris Matthews, like us, a presidential speechwriter, only his man was
right.
Jimmy Carter, said on the air, "I miss Pat already."
Mm-hmm.
And Matthews went on to say that there are two Pat Buchanans.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, one highly wonderful and positive. The other, well, that's the one that gets him into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the question. Why are you always picking a fight? There's a lot of what you could say that if you just softened the tone, you took out a barb, you left out the applause line at the end, you could make the same argument and carry more people with you.
Well, I think I don't know about that, but I do know this. If in this day and age, if you're not called some names and you've been in journalism as long as I have, then you probably haven't said anything very much worthwhile, in my judgment. I mean, because of the nature and character where the country is going. What are all these terms, racist, sexist, homophobic? They all say, they're all the same thing. They're synonyms for heretic. And what I am is a heretic to the conventional wisdom as it moves further and further left, and you're more and more outside. Things in that, I mean, my views in that book, many of them would not even have been controversial had they been written a while ago.
Within the Democratic Party, John Kennedy could have read all this. And
sure, I mean, but I think the country is moving this way,
right.
And I don't like where it's going. And I think what I've said in that book, I wouldn't take back a single word. And the people that don't like the book, they have not told me exactly what they don't like. I said, listen, of course, we could redact something if you guys like in the paperback, but they won't tell me the paragraph. They don't like that title, End of White America, or Death of, End of White America. What is the problem with that?
Everybody title, but you got it from The Atlantic or from some magazine.
Well, that's a cover of The Atlantic magazine,
right.
But you got all these columnists saying it. What isn't going to be great in 2042 when the European or white population's in a minority? And I asked myself, hey, wait a minute. When people look like me are in a minority, we're going to be a better country? Why?
Right. Chris Matthews again, quote, to Pat, the world can never be better than the one he grew up in as a young boy. Blessed Sacrament Church and grade school, Gonzaga High School, Georgetown University, no country will ever be better than the United States of America of the 1950s. Close quote.
Well, I think America, as I said, in the Eisenhower-Kennedy era, was a good country, a great country, the first country in the world. We had won World War II. We were leading the world in the Cold War. It was a united country. In many ways, post-1960, we have never really gotten that back. And what that book says is, I've come to the conclusion we ain't never going to get back the unity and the cohesion and the sense of one nation, one people under God that we had then.
So that's my final question for you, Pat. Suicide of a superpower. When it comes right down to it, do you see this as a call to action or a lament?
Well, if you're dealing with the political realm, like trade, I mean, you could solve, and we talked off camera, you and I could solve the Social Security problem. We could get a liberal fellow right here, and we could all get together and solve it in an afternoon. I can solve the problem of manufacturing and trade and all those things. I think the answers are in there. But if you're talking about the disintegration of a society, its breakdown, morally, culturally, politically, not politically, morally, culturally, socially. I would add, come to think of it, I would add politically. I think, as I said, you need a St. Paul. You don't need a Ronald Reagan. And I think that we've moved beyond that. And take a look at this world. I got a chapter in there of 18,000 words about a disintegrating world along the lines, first, of ethnicity and race, and secondly, of religious fundamentalism.
Chris Matthews, one final time. Loyalty defines Pat Buchanan. So I'm going to start something and let you finish it. Then outspake brave Horatius, the captain of the gate. Mm-hmm. To every man upon this earth, death cometh soon or late. Over to you, Pat.
Over to you. Just now.
And how can man die better?
Than facing fearful odds for the temples of his fathers and the ashes of his gods.
Patrick J. Buchanan.
I don't know where that came from.
Author of. I heard you. I knew you. You love it. Lays of Ancient Rome. Macaulay.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm.
Patrick J. Buchanan.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Facing fearful odds, suicide of a superpower. Thanks, Pat.
You've improved dramatically since you were an intern, Peter.
For Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.